in select theaters.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Today we're going to talk about Venezuela. We're also going to talk about immigration to the U.S. And later on, we'll open up the phone lines. We're joined now by investigative reporter Greg Palast. Greg is the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. And Greg joins us on the phone. Greg Palast, welcome back to MNF.
Glad to be with you again.
All right. So, Greg, let me read from the Associated Press this morning, and then let's start by talking about Venezuela. Yeah. On Wednesday of this week, Juan Guaido, the Venezuelan National Assembly president, who's leading the effort to remove President Nicolas Maduro from office, was stripped of his parliamentary immunity. Arrest seems increasingly likely. Guaido's chief of staff was jailed on March 22nd on charges of organizing a terrorist cell. 2 days later, two Russian military planes carrying 35 tons of unspecified equipment and 100 soldiers landed at the international airport in Caracas. Meanwhile, three blackouts left over 90% of the country in the dark. Since water pumps need electricity to run, neighborhoods and families were forced to organize water rationing systems or fetch water from polluted rivers and streams. Maduro blames the blackouts on sabotage by Guaido and the United States. The opposition blames government corruption and neglect of Venezuela's energy grid. Thousands of Venezuelans protesting the power outages on March 30th were met with violent repression. Counter-protesters came out in support of the Maduro government. And just again reading from the Associated Press, the Trump administration is renewing calls from Moscow to withdraw its military personnel from Venezuela, where they are helping prop up and battle President Nicolas Maduro. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told Fox and Friends this morning that he's seen no signs the Russian personnel were leaving and that Moscow's involvement might get worse before it gets better. U.S. and several dozen other nations have recognized Venezuela's opposition leader as the interim president, while Russia and China have staunchly backed Maduro. The Kremlin has rejected U.S. calls for Moscow to withdraw, saying U.S. troops are in many parts of the world and no one is telling America where it should or should not be. Greg Palast, you've been covering Venezuela. Tell me, what's your take on what's going on there right now and also about the news I just read?
Okay, well, that's a lot of stuff. I covered Venezuela for BBC Television and The Guardian, not the U.S. State Department. That's a strong distinction. So what the AP has done is what they do. They're not reporters, they're repeaters. They got a press release from the State Department, and they printed it. Look, the real story of Venezuela is black and white. In fact, if you go to gregpalast.com, you'll see two photos that I think explain the whole situation down there. First, you heard Juan Guaido, who was president of the National Assembly. By the way, for a dictatorship, they have the opposition very powerful. They have most of the media down there. They have giant demonstrations. That's some dictatorship. I was in other oil dictatorships that are so-called allies, like Kazakhstan. No, not one single member of an opposition in the assembly. And the mass murder of journalists who report on corruption there, that's not an issue. I know that Bill Clinton got a $500,000 fee from the Kazakh dictators. It's very important to understand why we're picking on Venezuela. But I said black and white. If you look at the National Assembly supporters of Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed, Trump-proclaimed president, never ran for president. It's not like he was cheated out. He said, oh, the election was unfair. Juan Guaido's supporters, if you look at the photo of his party's leaders, deputy members, there's about 60 on my site, and it is as white as a Republican Party meeting at a country club. Shiny white. In a nation which is mostly mestizo, dark-skinned folk, brown and black combinations, as Hugo Chavez told me, negro e indio, I look black and Indian. If you look at the pro-Chavista government, that is the people that supported Maduro, who is the successor to Chavez, you look at the bigger crowd, because they have most of the people, it looks like a meeting of the NAACP in Birmingham. And I say that because I was just at a meeting of the NAACP in Birmingham. It's almost all entirely dark-skinned folk, black and brown people, mestizos, as most of the nation. This is about a white supremacist takeover, attempt to take over the nation. This is Donald Trump's wet dream, in which white people will take back control of their nation, except The problem is you can't reverse what happened in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez, whether you like him or not, and you have a lot of Venezuelan exiles in your listening area, and they don't like him. And I'm going to be very blunt there. Take a look. They're probably mostly white and wealthy. And you had a white minority which controlled this country for 400 years until the Nelson Mandela of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, was elected. He gave the people housing, medicine, education, and they ain't going back, even if now they have to suffer. And it's true, the reports, let's go over a couple of ideas of the report. So it's about whether a white minority will seize control of the government. Guaido's never run for president. It was very funny to hear Kirsten Gillibrand, who's running a Democratic senator, say we have to recognize Guaido because he was the legitimately elected. Kirsten, when was that election? The other thing to look at is, yes, there is massive suffering there, and there are blackouts. I know Maduro, and I know his opposition. No, it doesn't have to be sabotaged by the U.S. It's much more insidious and worse. There is a embargo on the nation. The nation is sealed off. It can't export. It can't import. And it survives by exporting oil and importing finished products. For example, if a transformer, electric systems are very complex. I used to work with your Public Service Commission in Florida. Electric systems are complex. A transformer goes out. Those transformers come from Germany. And if you lose a transformer, you can't replace it because the German government is part of the embargo. You're not going to get your lights back on. It doesn't require CIA sabotage. The insulators, the whole system, and so the water systems can't be repaired. Why? It's corruption. Like I said, what I heard from oil company executives when I was covering Venezuela is that the problem with Chavez and his government is you couldn't bribe them. I'm not kidding. Remember, a mobile oil executive was found guilty and spent 3 years in prison for a $160 million bribe, ExxonMobil, of the Kazakh government. They left Venezuela because they couldn't bribe that government to have control of the oil. The British government is joining the embargo, the Tory right-wing government, which is far more unpopular in England than Maduro is in Venezuela. They still hang on. The British government, for example, wanted the Venezuelan oil field controlled by the French. The French Total company left. Last year, Britain said, give those oil fields to British Petroleum, to BP. The Venezuelan government said, no, that's our oil. We're keeping those fields. Suddenly, Britain joined the embargo and withheld $1.5 billion worth of gold. Gold bars held in the British exchequer. Instead of giving Venezuela its gold or the money for the gold, where they can buy food, they can buy to the transformers, they are withholding it. They're strangling it. And according to the UN rapporteur, that's the guy that the United Nations sends to be the independent investigator. He said this is a medieval siege. That's his term, medieval siege, which is strangling this nation and in his words, causing, that's the words of the United Nations expert, causing starvation in return for trying to squeeze the oil from this nation. So it's about race and it's about oil.
We're talking with Greg Palast. He's an investigative reporter. We're talking about Venezuela. Greg has covered Venezuela for The Guardian and the BBC television Newsnight program. And his BBC reports for the basis of his film, The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. You can find it at gregpalast.com. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Well, the argument goes, though, that Venezuela has so much oil, and it's got one of the largest oil reserves, if not the largest in the world. How could it screw it up? How could it not make money from that? You're saying that the embargo is the reason why it's not able to get the kind of foreign exchange that they should be able to get?
That's right. Oh, well, it's real simple. One, they're barred from selling their oil in most places. Now, the number one customer, and you'll love this, of Venezuelan oil is Coke. Are the Koch brothers, Koch Industries Gulf Coast Refinery. Most of the oil went to the U.S., and most of that oil went to the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers have not paid for their oil that they took from Venezuela. Instead, it's been seized and held by Steve Mnuchin, the U.S. Treasury Secretary. So the oil money has been embargoed. Yes, Venezuela has a ton of oil, but there's two problems. Number one is that they can't get it out. They can't drill it because, again, you don't have parts. They don't machine they don't create the parts for the oil industry in Venezuela. They have to import the parts. They export the oil. The U.S. government has effectively seized Citgo and the refineries, the Citgo refineries on the Gulf Coast. And I got to tell you, if you had this embargo on Florida, you'd probably be hunting for food tonight out of a garbage can, Rob. The same type of embargo on Florida would be absolutely crushing and devastating, where you couldn't get your produce out from Florida and you couldn't import anything else from the rest of the United States. This is Venezuela's problem. So they've taken the money from the oil, and they are sequestering it at the U.S. Treasury. And they said it can only be released by this self-proclaimed, Trump-proclaimed president, Guaido. So, yeah, they have a ton of oil. They can't drill it. They can't sell it. And they can't get the money that's owed for that oil.
All right, the other complaint you hear is that Venezuela hasn't maintained its oil fields, its oil infrastructure, and it hasn't maintained its electrical grid. And it hasn't put the money back into its economy like it should. And they're pointing to both the Chavez government and to the Maduro government. The critics are pointing to it as saying, well, they haven't reinvested. That's why their systems are breaking down in Venezuela.
Okay. Let's, you know what? If you embargoed, the electric system of Florida, you'd be talking to me in the dark now on a tin can with a string instead of on a telephone line. So it's really simple. You can't get the parts. They won't give them the money to buy the material to invest in the oil system, and they won't let them buy it. It's embargoed. Embargoed. I don't get what people don't understand about the term embargo. It's a siege, as the United Nations says. They are not allowed to fix their system. They're not allowed their own money to fix the system. It's as if I said, if I punched you in the stomach and you doubled over and said, why can't you stand up straight? And punch you again in the stomach and say, why aren't you standing up straight? And hit you in the face and say, why are you doubled over? The answer is because I'm hitting you in the face and I'm kicking you in the stomach. So that's what they're doing to Venezuela. It's punching this nation, brutalizing this nation. I'm telling you, Florida could not withstand this. I think it's amazing that Venezuela has done better than what I'm sure Florida would do. Florida would collapse. You had a hurricane there and everyone's in tears. You know, that's nothing compared to what's happening to Venezuela. And by the way, when you talk about reinvestment, let me just read you one single sentence from the U.S. CIA's internal fact book about Venezuela. And this is important. It says, quote, this is CIA, social investments in Venezuela during the Chavez administration reduced poverty from nearly 50% in 1999 when he won office, to about 27% in 2011, when he died. Increased school enrollment, substantially decreased infant and child mortality, and improved access to potable water and sanitation through social investment. Yes, the money was not in... One of the big beneficiaries of Venezuelan oil has always been Miami and Florida. The massive money that was stolen from Venezuela before Chavez came in and flooded Florida. How many Venezuelans kept a second apartment? Where did they get that money to invest in Florida? And so what Chavez said is, well, instead of the money going to Florida, it's going to stay here in Venezuela. And that's the CIA saying he cut poverty in half. I wrote about Venezuela in 1976. 1 million families lived in cardboard shacks with tin roofs in Caracas. Now those shanty towns have almost completely been replaced by apartments built by the Chavez government. Now, is the system collapsing? Is it collapsing under Maduro? Absolutely, because like I say, they're under siege. And by the way, I'm not a big, I know Maduro personally, but I'm not a big fan of him as president. I'm going to tell you right now. I mean, I think his vice president is very qualified. I think that Maduro is over his head. He makes claims like, the electric system is on when the people are sitting in the dark. Silly things like that. You know, he pretends that the embargo is not hurting him. But I would rather go by the rapporteur's independent analysis that they're under siege and that they're starving, and my own reporters that are working with me on the ground there. It is It's horrendous right now.
We're talking with Greg Palast. He's an investigative reporter. We're talking about Venezuela right now. We're going to also talk about immigration to the U.S. Greg, there's a lot of Latin American countries and Central American countries that people are fleeing. They're fleeing Honduras. They're fleeing El Salvador. They're fleeing Guatemala. And 3 million people have fled Venezuela. Some, as you have said, have come here to the Tampa Bay area. They've gone to Miami. They've gone to places like Colombia. Why are they leaving?
Well, like I said, it's under siege. You can't get food. If you have diabetes, there's not enough medicine for insulin. Now, understand, once again, this is not because ridiculous stories in the New York Times, oh, they're withholding medicine from people so that then they can release it when Maduro runs for re-election. It's silly stuff like that. No, they're under a siege. Go ahead and I'll tell you what. Go try to send medicine packages to Venezuela. Try to send anything to Venezuela. There's an embargo. And that is the cause of this misery, that they're holding back Venezuela's oil money. They're not letting them sell to most places, like the U.K. is embargoing them, very convenient for British Petroleum. Same with Canada, which is competing with Venezuela's heavy oil from the tar sands of Canada. So people are leaving because you can't get food, you can't get medicine, employment is plummeting. You know, you can even be the strongest Chavista ever, but you're going to get out if you can. But most of the people who have money are white and elite and well-educated. They speak English. Those are the people that get out, get to Miami. And when you hear complaints about the current government of Venezuela, I hate to say it, look, it's getting clearer. If they speak English, they've got money, and they're white. I can tell you what their political position is, and that's just the cold truth.
All right, so what do you make of the U.S. is calling for regime change in Venezuela? It's not calling for regime change in Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. What do you make of that?
Well, what I make of it, and actually more interesting, they're not calling for regime change in the dictatorship known as Saudi Arabia. Remember, Saudi royals are just dictators in bathrobes. We're not talking about the bone sawers in Saudi Arabia, them going. It's not regime change. They're actually talking about openly, John Bolton, the ultra-right neocon that sold us the Iraq war, he's selling us war in Venezuela. Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed president, self-proclaimed, he never ran, has called, if necessary, he says, if Maduro won't leave, for an invasion by the U.S. military. Now, as you know, in the United States Constitution, when you join with a foreign government to call for an invasion of your nation, that's known as treason. And it's punishable by death in the United States in our Constitution, the only crime that's so where the punishment is named. It's death. And this guy is purely by definition a traitor. And if now we have Democrats who are now saying Donald Trump, Pompeo, and Elliot Abrams, who is brought back out of the skeleton closet to go down to Venezuela, that these are now foreign policy geniuses. I'm sorry, they sold me one war in Iraq. They're not going to sell it to me a new war a second time. So Guaido has actually called for foreign intervention, the overthrow of his government. Regime change is a polite word, but we're not using that word for any of the oil dictatorships where we get our next fix of petroleum.
You know, I've been reading some writings from inside Venezuela, and they say that the Venezuelan people are not likely to rise up against each other. Are you seeing the same kind of things, that even though if the U.S. wants a civil war and wants people to take sides in it, inside Venezuela, they're not that eager to fight each other? Have you seen that?
I hate to say it. I actually think that it might end up in a civil war.
Okay, why is it?
Being down there, people are heavily armed on both sides. And you see massive anti-government demonstrations, massive pro-government demonstrations, and people feel very violently about this stuff. In other words, the people who lived in the shanty towns, and they now live in buildings, and they have a Cuban doctor in the basement, and which is what I saw, and they're not going to give that up without a fight, and I think it could be with guns. I mean, I actually think that Venezuela is quite riven by race and class, and that I could very much see a very violent civil war.
But if only 22% of the country is European, the rest is African, mestizo, indigenous, I mean, the numbers would be against... If the majority wins,
well,
the numbers would be against
calling,
the Europeans.
That's why Guaido is calling for the U.S. military intervention and intervention from the new right-wing government of Brazil, et cetera, because obviously the whites are outnumbered. But they also have the money. They have the power. And as you saw in South Africa, as you saw in Rhodesia, as you've seen in other nations, you can have a rich, powerful minority violently oppress a minority, which is what happened in Venezuela a long time. But I hate to predict the outcome of a civil war which hasn't started. I'm hoping and praying against it as a person, but as a reporter, I have to say, man, is it tense.
Greg Palast is our guest, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's see if we've had a caller on the line for about 20 minutes, and I wonder if he has a question for you, Greg. This is Ben in Tampa. Ben, do you have a question for Greg Palast?
Oh, yeah. Man, I finally get to speak to Greg Palast.
Thanks.
Greg,
yes?
I saw an interview that you did with Alex Jones, no less, from back in 2006 with the Armed Madhouse book.
Yes.
And the thing that got me, I don't know, you kind of stated it a little bit right now in the talk. For me, it was a light bulb epiphany moment that our foreign policy in relation to oil, whether it be Venezuela, Iran, Libya, pretty much everybody but Saudi Arabia, is not to control it, to get it, to bring it over here, but to just keep it in the ground.
So yes, it's a very interesting thing.
Oil sells for more along with the Saudis' oil.
Yes, very interesting point. And by the way, I want to say that, yes, 12 years ago, 13 years ago, I was on Alex Jones before he went over to the dark side, and he was kind of a populist progressive a long time ago. But a very important point is when I was doing an investigation of the Iraq War, and I was in places like Baku and Astana in the Caspian Sea, big oil companies are interested about gaining control of oil fields. Exxon wants its Venezuelan oil field back. In fact, John Bolton, our NSA chief, said he has talked to Exxon. He's proudly said so on the air that Exxon will come in, come back, and take control of Venezuela fields. Control is a very important point. It's not necessarily to get the oil. When the price of oil drops, these guys want control so they can shut down the field. I saw this in Azerbaijan. I saw this in Kazakhstan. I saw this in Iraq, is that you get control of a field, and then you don't drill it to keep the price of oil up. And then when the price of oil is way up, you release some. So control is not just seizing oil. It's, in some cases, keeping it in the ground. So it's the control, it's not the seizure of the actual petroleum. But thank you for bringing up that subtle point.
All right,
thanks,
Ben.
Thanks for letting me talk to you.
Thanks, Ben. Here's a question from Gina. She says, what is Marco Rubio's involvement? Why is he so anti-Maduro? And isn't this against Trump's pledge to stay away from regime change? This is like what the U.S. did in Guatemala in the 1950s, writes Gina. That's her question.
Yes. the fact that Donald Trump has contradicted himself, what a shock. This would be just go add that to the list of contradictions of promises made and broken. But, yes, it's very much not only like what Mossadegh nationalized the oil fields of Iran, we supported the overthrow, the CIA engineered the overthrow of the government by activating the Ayatollahs. That's paid us back pretty dangerously. It's a reason not to kick these hornets over and get rid of democracies. We overthrew, and we supported, the United States under Bush supported the kidnapping and the coup d'etat attempt against Hugo Chavez in 2002. I was down there when he was kidnapped, and the New York Times, interestingly, reported that Chavez had resigned as president. And I called the New York Times and said, where'd you get this idea that he resigned? Because I got the information that he was kidnapped from one of Chavez's generals. And they said, oh, we got it from the State Department. I mean, I have to tell you, Rob, when I was at The Guardian, if I said I got my information from the State Department or the UK Foreign Office, I'd have been fired. But that's the type of news we get. So it's very much like what we tried to do with removing Chavez in 2002, what we did in Iran with Mossadegh, and obviously the Gulf War One was to protect the Kuwaiti oil fields. You know, if there was broccoli in, as Senator Moynihan at the time said, if Kuwait grew broccoli instead of oil, we wouldn't care.
Greg Palast is an investigative reporter. He's covered Venezuela for The Guardian and the BBC. He's the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. And he's also done investigative reporting for Rolling Stone and Democracy Now. And this is WMNF 88.5 FM. Greg, you have a few more minutes. We've got almost every line lit. And I wanted to ask you about Kris Kobach, the president. The president wants to name an immigration czar, and Kris Kobach, who was the elections secretary of state, I believe, in Kansas, is his number one choice. Tell us about Kris Kobach.
Again, if you go to gregpalast.com, you'll see Trump may name Kris Kobach new immigration czar, and I say the real agenda is the 2020 election, vote suppression. Kris Kobach, who I investigated for 6 years for Rolling Stone and Al Jazeera, is kind of the vote thief in chief for Donald Trump for some bad poetry. He's the guy who came up, for example, with the idea that you should prove you're a citizen in order to vote. Now, that was thrown up by federal courts in when he implemented that in Kansas. And by the way, you might say, hey, wait, people should be citizens to vote. Yes, but we're not Red China. We don't have citizenship cards that we carry around. This resulted in Kansas, for example, 36,000 people, mostly students, and some Air Force officers being denied the right to vote in 2016. And Kobach admitted to the federal court that not one of the tens of thousands of people he blocked from registering, not one, was an alien voter. This was tried in, and so he's pushing this. If he becomes czar of immigration, that puts him over Homeland Security, over the census, where, by the way, it was Kobach who came up with the question to add to the census, are you an alien and is there an alien in your household? Very dangerous question. It stops people from answering the census and cuts the amount of representation you get in a congressional district with Hispanics.
Now, people that support that would say, well, look, if you're a non-citizen, that should be a question that the census should ask. What does the Constitution say about the census question?
The Constitution says that we have to take a census of the public, how many residents, how many people are in America. By the way, that
it doesn't say citizen. It doesn't say citizen in the Constitution.
No, because the important thing is that you represent the people of your district. And you get congressional representation and money for things like hurricane recovery based on your population. And the population is recorded by the census. So that's why the Founding Fathers wanted to know, and especially in those early days when you had American natives, you had all kinds of giant immigrant population, et cetera, how many people actually live in these United States? And so it's because the other thing is, a census is supposed to count people. It's not supposed to be coming up with ways to scare people away from being counted. But even worse, if Kobach has actually said, and I've talked to him, that if he has control of the census through Homeland, through the Commerce Department, and immigration through Homeland Security. Remember, he's a czar. He's going to cover all these agencies: Defense, Human Health and Human Services, etc. That his plan, he said it openly, is to take the census statements where you say you're an alien or you have an alien in your household and compare them to voter rolls to remove illegal aliens. Now, as you know, Rob, Florida is the one state that actually tried this, like hunting for aliens on the voter rolls under back in 2012. And in 2012, the state of Florida identified 181,000 potential aliens in the state of Florida. 181,000. You know, all these people swimming from Salvador to Key Biscayne just to vote, right? Well, they after they did this harass people, people were required to go to court to prove the Americans to prove that they were citizens. Not easy to do. Out of 181,000 suspects, they removed thousands and thousands from the voter rolls in your state. They found one single alien voter and convicted him, an Austrian registered as a Republican. So one Republican Austrian, and thousands of people with names like Garcia were removed, because what they want to do is take, if a Jose Garcia was deported, they want to then find a Jose Garcia in Florida, and they say, aha, that's the same guy, even though, by the way, I've seen how Kobach runs his list. They have different middle names. I have his list. I actually have his list. And so Jose Garcia, every Jose Garcia in Florida is under threat of losing their vote unless they prove they're citizens. And by the way, it's not so easy. Being in the military is not proof of citizenship. Driver's license, Social Security card, not proof of citizenship. You need a passport, kind of a white, rich white citizen's document, or you need your original birth certificate. And that's been, as it turns out, that's really, really difficult for a lot of people, especially students and young people.
Well, we're talking with Greg Pallas. He's the investigative reporter. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Alvaro, who's in Tampa. Alvaro, what's your question for Greg?
Hello. Thank you, Rob. Welcome back. Thank you for the program, and thank you for the information. Wonderful information. I wanted to make a comparison between Colombia and Venezuela as it relates to water and electricity going out. In Venezuela, probably because of the oil money, all those systems are more advanced. At the same time, the population is not ready as they are in Colombia. In Colombia, most houses have a large container to get rainwater, but also to gain water when the water comes back. You have a large container that gets filled up first. When the water goes out, which is normal for the water to go out, then people use that by gravity, use that to bathe and to cook and whatever for the house needs. Venezuela doesn't have that. Venezuela was now, during this recent problem, getting the 55-gallon tanks, people trying to get those kind of gallons and smaller ones to be able to resolve their problem. When the electricity goes off, all of Colombia knows to have, candles and stuff like that. They always have, that is not seen in Venezuela. A big to-do, and it still is, for people to resolve problems of electricity and water, because I guess the systems are more advanced than they are in Colombia. The water going down, the electricity going down is something normal in Colombia.
Yes. You bring up an important point, Alvaro. In Venezuela, it's been 20 years since people have had those defensive skills of poverty. In other words, when your water system goes out, you have a rain barrel. When your electric system goes out, you have your candles and you have your small generators in the neighborhood, etc. Because Chavez returned the oil money to the people and they moved out of shanty towns and into these 15-story apartment
buildings. Beautiful homes,
They lost the kind of skills you need to survive in third world conditions, and so it's particularly horrendous. The people of Venezuela were not prepared for this embargo by any means, and I'm just sorry in a way that Maduro seems to be a little bit like a deer in the headlights. I know some of my friends on the left won't like me saying that,
but he hasn't prepared the people for this. I follow you for many years, but I think they have been so careful. They have been so sharp in terms of their decisions. They have won practically every battle, every challenge the United States has launched, and the opposition has launched at them, everyone, including the last one. And this guy, Guaido, big to-do, big star. Right now he's totally losing power, totally being discredited, even by his own people being discredited. And so they have been very cautious, very careful, proceeding very intelligently, and winning just about every battle. They are in for the long run. And I think this is it's scary. Their suffering is hard, but I don't see them weak at all.
All right.
Let me
Alvaro, thanks
you,
a lot.
Go ahead. If you don't mind me ask you, Alvaro.
Yes.
The question that Rob sent put to me, because you might have a different perspective. Do you think that Venezuela, given the kind of white rich minority behind Guaido and the majority mestizo population, do you think that there could be a civil war that could break out here?
Well, I don't know. I do see the spirits on both sides being very strong. But I do see something that I'm not sure you mentioned, but when the Venezuelan opposition has always been very strong. Since Guaido came out, huge crowds, came out. After
yes.
that, and it has been traditionally, only the whites, only, you do see poor people and you do see some of them very angry and many of them leaving and stuff like that. If there was a confrontation, I don't think they would stand a chance. If there was a civil war, they would not stand a chance.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Alvaro, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Greg, we have an all-news and talk channel called HD3 here at WMNF, The Source, okay. And you've been on several of our shows on HD3, the Tom Hartman Show and the Jimmy Dore Show, and I heard you say the other day, I think on Tom Hartman, that the 2016 election in Florida, in which Andrew Gillum was facing Ron DeSantis for governor, you said that election was stolen, and I don't think the host followed up on the question, so let me follow up. Do you think the 2016 election here in Florida was stolen?
Ah, that's a good one. Let's go back a little bit. Let me just pull up that article from my own site, because I sent a team down to Florida. I was covering the election in Georgia with Stacey Abrams. And one of the things that you have, one, you have that leftover people that were showed up and were surprised that they were not on the rolls, a lot of them, because they were knocked off from that ancient old system of identifying people as supposed aliens. The other problem you had, of course, is that I'm the reporter who back in 2000 uncovered that the state of Florida had removed, under Catherine Harris and under Jeb Bush, had removed tens of thousands of black people, calling them felons. And of the list I got, which 58,000 people in Florida, mostly black folk called the felons, who were at the time not permitted to vote, not one, and I want to emphasize this, not one out of those tens of thousands were actually felons not allowed to vote in Florida. These are all innocent people. Their only crime was voting while black. And every single time I have looked at the Florida rolls, I see the same thing. That thing has never, never been fixed. We had one guy in your listening area. Hi, Willie Steen, a Gulf War veteran, who was removed by Catherine Harris before the 2000 election, which, by the way, if you remember, Bush became president by just 537 votes in Florida, with tens of thousands of black people excluded from the rolls, falsely called felons, including Willie Steen of Tampa. And then I went back in 2004. He was removed again and again and again. When you had this big vote saying ex-cons, you serve your sentence, you can vote. Now there's a big war over DeSantis, trying to slow that up, et cetera.
Right.
But I got to tell you right now, your voter rolls are completely a mess, and they will like it that way because it's excluding people who they say are non-citizens because their last name's Garcia. It's excluding felons because they've got guys named Jackson, and some guy in Ohio named Jackson was convicted of a crime. And that's, your Florida rolls are a complete mess. And plus, of course, you have the massive, massive problem of long lines in black areas and short lines in white areas. It's not a small matter when you're talking about a few thousand votes that determine the governorship.
Yeah, I think I saw those massive lines in Ohio in one of your films.
Yes. One of the things, I have a film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. In fact, it just came out in an activist edition. If you have an activist group or a not-for-profit group, you can get a showing for free. But one of the you know, one of the problems, again, is that throughout the United States, for example, in Ohio, I went to before the last election, before the 2016 election, I went to Dayton, Ohio, where people were waiting 5 hours in line to vote, early voting. There was one polling station for 80,000 people. And then I went to the white suburbs of Toledo, and the only line there was poll workers waiting. You know, they had so many poll workers that they had more poll workers than voters. Mm. They were serving coffee and cookies. And this is throughout the nation, and Florida is one of the worst when it comes to deliberately cutting the number of machines in polling stations within black areas. You also have a problem of what's called spoilage in Florida, where you have a lot of votes. This is a little secret of America, and this was pointed out to me by the dean of Florida elections officials, Ion Sancho, who point out the massive number of votes that are never counted in Florida for a technical reason. Now, you may, you know, a glitch in the machine, you fill out a vote, but the machine doesn't read the vote. Even if you fill it out on paper, it's machine read. In Florida, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission actually did an investigation, found that your chance of losing your vote for a technical reason, like the ballot didn't get counted, something like that, is 900% higher if you're African-American than if you're white in Florida. 900% higher percentage of losing your vote to what's called spoilage. And, you know, this is how you swipe elections when they're close.
Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our guest is investigative reporter Greg Palast. Among his books, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Thanks to Patty Perkey and Frank Knox, our phone producers today. If you've got a question for Greg, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Lots of email questions, Greg. Kat writes, thanks for inviting Greg Palast to get the truth over the airwaves. And Kat says, how serious is Russia's involvement in Venezuela? Will they retaliate with a military strike, writes Kat?
Wow. I hate seeing this type of escalation, but as you remember, the Russians stopped the Obama administration from taking any action from, you know, because he hesitated, and Russia moved in several wings, Air Force, you know, several wings of their fighter jets into Syria, and it stopped any attack on the horrific Syrian government. Here, I guess the Russians are figuring they, you know, since Pompeo, our Secretary of State, Elliot Abrams, who was Mr. Death Squad from Central America, who's now the special envoy to Venezuela, and, you know, NSA's John Bolton, who talked us into Iraq, I guess the Russians are saying, well, if we send in some of our military, the U.S. Would be afraid to invade and to, you know, trigger a war between us and Russia. I that's probably their geopolitical move, and I think it's very dangerous on all sides, but it probably will work.
DeMarco has this question. He says, what about the military coup in Honduras that took the democratically elected leader out of that country in his pajamas and that Hillary Clinton refused to call a coup? Does your guest think this coup led to the murder of environmental activist Berta Cáceres and the caravans from Honduras heading north to the U.S.? And then DeMarco goes on to say, I believe the U.S. foreign policy is second only to Mother Nature as a cause of the world refugee crisis.
As to this, I can't make a general statement, but as to the specifics, absolutely. And it's shameful that it was Hillary Clinton under the Obama administration that endorsed, recognized the military, the military dictators who overthrew the elected president of Honduras. The result was I saw this in Mexico in 2006, when the current president, AMLO, he ran and lost. The election was stolen from him there in 2006. When you delegitimize government, then you have illegitimate government. You know, then the illegitimate government has no authority over the nation. And that leaves, when you have a nation that now has no legitimate government, then that's just the open field. A lot of good writing by this, by Loretta Napolitano. This creates the open field for narco-traficantes, and this type of gangs and gangsters who have taken over Honduras. So there, you know, you reap the whirlwind when you pull stunts like that. So we didn't like the leftist president of Honduras. He was overthrown. But instead of really a right-wing government, you ended up really with no government, and the narcos moved right in, and people are scared to death, and they are leaving in droves. In fact, in the middle of this conversation, I just got a call from Honduras from a friend of mine, who is trying to get to America. And you can't blame them. They're fighting for their lives.
You can find our guest at gregpalast.com, and Palast is spelled P-A-L-A-S-T. Well, let's go to Gino in Tampa. Gino, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
Well, I love the conversation, and welcome back, Rob.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, this is a great history lesson for a lot of people, and also it answers Trump's question of the name of a country where they have a black leader that's not an asshole country. And what happens is the Europeans go and they strip all the goods from out of the country. You take South Africa, the beers is down there, stripping and killing people. And the country that's down there that they stripped all the rubber off of, and when they didn't want to work, they cut their arms off. They actually cut their arms off down in Africa. The same way down in Venezuela. What's going on is that, sure, there are a lot of people that are African, and all through the Caribbean and South and Central America. See, only 250,000 Africans came to the United States as we know today. We populated to the numbers that we have today. The majority of them went to South and Central America today, and that's what happened. The Europeans go down there, and they kill those people. Now, a lot of countries, there are a few countries in the Caribbean, like Dominican Republic, that don't want to say that they're black, but they are black. And that's what's going on. And he's right. They separate them they go down there and take their oil, seize their oil, and they separate them by class, by color. And that's what they're doing today. Thank you.
All right, Gino, thanks for your statement. Greg, do you want to comment about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of points, babe, but let me start with the early one about our support of we don't mind black folk controlling a government as long as they're willing to give up their resources. And we corrupt these governments. I remember when Obama went to Africa and said, "You corrupt, you know, you people are taking bribes." Well, excuse me, Mr. Obama, who is paying the bribes? You know, I was in the Congo, the DRC in the Congo, after a civil war that killed 3 million people. Because we had installed a guy named Mobutu over the Congo, and giving up the diamonds to. By the way, the Reverend Pat Robertson owned the diamond mines of the Congo. That's how he became rich, and cuddled up with and Robertson convinced, for example, George Bush to continue to cuddle up to Mobutu so he could take the diamonds. This is an old story, and when you talk about people cutting off arms, I got to tell you, this caller isn't exaggerating. I was in Liberia after the Civil War, and as I've written, it was actually hard to find a teenage boy, with all four limbs. It was hard. Literally, most teenage boys I encountered in Liberia were missing an arm because, again, it was a grab for the resources, rubber, diamonds, hardwood, and what happens is we suck out these resources, and then you end up with the only way people can survive is to be in these illegal trades, and there's gangster wars over control of these resources. Charles Taylor who is the president of Liberia, that was basically installed by Jimmy Carter, who is now in prison for war crimes. For the trade in blood diamonds, that is, people die to get these diamonds. It's gangster diamonds. And, even Jimmy Carter got involved in supporting this type of nonsense because of supposed American geopolitical interest. But, I think in the long run, as we found out about Honduras, as we found out about Iran, as we found out about several African countries, when you start kicking over the elected Democratic leaders, it may not be instant. You may think you've won some geopolitical gain for the United States, But in the long run, this comes back to bite us. It's so dangerous. And so, yes, so the caller's brought up something important. It's just the creation of these pliant, corrupting dictatorships. But we are the corruptors, and we love the corruption because we get the resources cheap.
Just getting back to Venezuela, the U.S. is saying this: the National Assembly President Juan Guaido is the legitimate leader in Venezuela, although he wasn't elected. As you pointed out, the European countries are tending to back the U.S. Countries like Britain are backing the U.S. in Venezuela. We're also in opposition to China and Russia, who don't agree with our policy in Venezuela. And then you've got the Vatican and Mexico saying that there should be some negotiations. They want to be involved in negotiations. They haven't taken sides. Where do you think this is headed? How does it resolve itself?
Whoa. Well, you know, unfortunately, Venezuela has both the blessing and curse of being on top of the world's largest reserve of oil. And, you know, the Vatican is not interested in oil, and Mexico has its own oil and is headed by one of the most intelligent national leaders I've ever met, Andres Lopez Obrador. And, you know, I would love AMLO, as he's called, and Francis, Pope Francis, to step in. But I don't think that, you know, Mike Pompeo and Elliot Abrams are going to say, we don't want no, they don't want no peaceniks in there talking about a peaceful settlement. I don't think that's going to happen.
Greg Pallas, thanks for getting up early out there in Los Angeles, and thanks for spending a whole hour with us. Your films are online. Tell us about what they can find online when they go to gregpallas.com.
Well, you can get a free download of my BBC report collected as the assassination of Hugo Chavez. By the way, he wasn't assassinated. That's just the name of the film. The assassination of Hugo Chavez, free download. And you can also get download a copy at the site of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which has everything from Venezuela to the elections in Florida.
Greg Pallas, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming up on WMNF.
Thanks, Rob.
All right, great to talk to you. That's Greg Pallas, who is an investigative reporter. He's written for The Guardian. He's covered news for the BBC. And he's written several best-selling books, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. He's also written for Rolling Stone, and you can find him at gregpallast, PALAST.com. And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. I'm going to read just some of these emails. Thank you for having Greg Pallas back on the air to discuss the situation in Venezuela. Radioactivity is one of the few venues to give news, listeners, and anti-interventionist perspective on the Maduro government. And Mr. Pallas has provided us information to counter the imperialist narrative coming from mainstream news and NPR. Once again, it's all about the oil, writes James. And Adam writes this, thank you so much for having Greg on today. This has been informative, and it's great to hear the truth about Venezuela. The mainstream media has been totally failing in their coverage, and it's maddening. Please do more interviews with Greg Pallas. He's such a wealth of knowledge on a range of issues. And Mike writes this, who are the Russians backing in Venezuela? They are backing the Maduro government right now. That's who they are backing, Mike. Thank you for that. And Chuck writes, welcome back. Thank you, Chuck. And Ben writes, I don't know how I found his Alex Jones interview the first time. Maybe someone sent me a link to hear Greg Pallas. I was just taking off to go to my place in Plant City when I heard you were having Greg on. I turned back to the house because if I had a chance to talk to him, I was going to try my best to do so, writes Ben, who was one of our earlier callers today. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back coming up Monday. Just a note that tonight at 8:30 on WEDU's Florida This Week, I'll be hosting a debate between David Straz and Jane Castor, the two candidates for mayor of Tampa. That's tonight at 8:30 on WEDU-TV. And we'll be playing the audio of that this coming Monday at 11 o'clock. Coming up in the next hour, Janelle Irwin is out. She's got a sick daughter. She's at home with her daughter today. So we're going to hear an edition of the Tom Hartman program. We should be able to pick him up live from his from his studios in Portland, Oregon. And that's what's coming up in the next hour. And then stay tuned after that for Art in Your Ear with Joellen Schulke. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Have a great weekend.
I'm not